So please welcome Dean Thompson.
So the origins of my chance encounter started way back in my 23rd year. And at the time, I was just out of college studying wildlife biology, and my supervisor at the time, Brian, asked me if I wanted to go to the Sierra Nevada and survey for peregrine falcons and other raptors and release peregrine falcons out into the wild at a hack site in the summertime. And I thought, yeah, sure. Definitely I wanted to go. He said, well, I actually need two people. Maybe you can find somebody else to go with you. And so immediately I thought, okay, I got to find some girls to go with me. So I tried to find a girl to go with me to no avail. So I went up by myself, and I was up in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada for several days, wandering around looking for birds of prey. And then I got a phone call from Brian saying, hey, I actually found somebody else to come and help you. His name is John Ball. He's kind of a different guy. I hope you get along. And then he hung up. And I'm thinking to myself, what does that mean? And several days later, I'm sitting outside the cabin watching nighthawks and bats catch insects in the twilight, and I can hear the sound of a heavy vehicle coming up the road. And as it's coming up the road, I can hear it thumping with music. And as it gets closer, I realize that that's Pink Floyd, Welcome to the Machine. And up comes this large blue van, and it's John Ball, John Allen Zach Ball. Many people called him Zach. I called him John. And there he was. And John, at the time, was living out of a 72 International Metro van. And basically, it was a converted bread truck that he converted into what he called the Vandominium. And it had a bed in the back, a nice curtain there, built-in cupboards, a nice stereo system, little colored lights in there. And he had been living out of it for a while. He lived in the winter over in Mammoth that past winter. It was an El Nino winter. They had 35 feet of snow on the ground. His van was parked in a snowbank. He had a snow cave that went down to the van. He had electricity in there, a heat source in there, and he lived there the entire winter. And before I met him, about a week before I met him, he spent a couple of days digging it out, and he drove over to the west side, and he was here to help me look for birds of prey. And even though this encounter with him was a planned encounter, not my chance encounter, my time spent with him and the encounter I had with this man profoundly affected my life and the path of my life. And John Ball was one of those people that if anybody spent time with him, they couldn't help but have the path of their life altered by the gravity of his massive personality and ego. I mean, he was educated as an English major in UCLA. He loved to write poetry. He was really liked weapons. He was a falconer. He was a lunatic, a crazy person to some people, a loyal friend to other people, and he was my field partner for many, many years. We did a lot of work with each other until he died an early death in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada in an ultralight crash on Earth Day. And sometimes I think, you know, the hottest fires burn out the quickest. But that first year that we met was just an amazing, enchanted year because it was the springtime after an El Nino winter, and the grass and the hills were just green. There was flowers everywhere. The rivers were roaring. The waterfalls were spectacular. And we were just looking for birds of prey. And we'd wander through the woods and through the foothills and scramble around on cliffs and gaze out over the valleys and looking for birds of prey. And as the snow melted and we were able to go a little bit higher, and we just followed springtime up the mountain as the weeks went on, we just got higher and higher into the pine forests. And then that summer, we released peregrine falcons at a release site on the South Fork of the Kings River, and it didn't really go very well. It was a learning experience, and as I always say, a learning experience is what you get when you didn't get what you wanted, all right? And but that hack site is a whole different story for an entirely different time. The highlight of our summer, I think, was when we got to do our goshawk surveys up in the high country of the Sierra, and we were flown in by helicopter and dropped off at a snow surveyor's cabin at about 10,000 feet, right on the banks of the North Fork of the Kings River. And it was a log cabin affair, a steel roof, a little pot-bellied stove in there, some beds in there. And since we were flown in, we were able to bring plenty of food, lots of good food, which we supplemented with trout from the creek. And we were also able to bring in a case of beer, which we had cooling in the creek down below the cabin. And these goshawk surveys were required because PG&E was doing hydroelectric projects there. They were planning to build a bunch of diversion dams there, and so they had to account for any sensitive or endangered species that might be in that area. And so we were there to find goshawks, to see if there were nesting goshawks there. Now, goshawks are North America's largest accipiter. They're closely related to Cooper's hawks and Sharpshin hawks. They're a secretive, stealthy hawk. They don't rely on power like eagles or speed like falcons. They rely on ambush and surprise for killing their prey. And rarely do they get up and soar in the open air. So they're not easy birds to find. And these were these elusive birds that we were up there to look for. And basically, what our days consisted of, and we were there for 12 days staying up there, and our days consisted of getting up in the morning, eating a quick breakfast, and going out and surveying a drainage. And we would go up and we would just walk through the woods and look for birds and look for sign, and sometimes we'd work our way up a drainage and down the other side. Sometimes one of us would sit up on the side of a hill overlooking some nice habitat, and the other person would wander through the forest to see if they flushed anything out. We'd sit by meadows and just relax by the meadow and just watch it for a while to see if anything would come out. Sometimes we split up, and he'd take one drainage, I would take another drainage, and we would agree to meet at a predetermined spot somewhere in the wilderness at a certain amount of time, and then we'd meet there for lunch and talk about what we saw, and then we'd split up again and meet back at the cabin. And I think back on it now, it's like we didn't have, cell phones or radios or GPS. It was just us, our knowledge of the area, and topo maps and our watch. And that's basically what we did and how we met. And if there were times we'd sit there and it's like, well, we were supposed to meet an hour ago, but he's not here. And you didn't start worrying until maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours later, and then you start looking or whatever. Nothing really bad ever happened. But it was really fun. We do that during the day, and then at night, of course, we go back to the cabin, no TV, very little light, so we would, plan our next day, and then we'd play cards or read, or sometimes we'd just go out and just lay out on the granite and look up at the impossible number of stars and just philosophize and talk as we stared up into the sky. And it was such a special time, but at the same time, it was so frustrating and so aggravating because we had to find nesting goshawks. It was this cloud that was over us, and that's why we were there. And we saw molted feathers of goshawks. We saw old nests. We found plucking posts. We found fresh grouse kills. We saw fleeting glimpses of adult goshawks flying away, but we never found the nest. And we were searching and searching and searching, and it was just driving us crazy. I mean, we were the pros from Dover. We were supposed to go in there and find these things and find these goshawks. And after about a week of doing this, we were sitting there on this rocky bench above this one drainage, and we're trying to figure out where we're going to go again and try and look for these birds. And John just stops. He goes, "This is stupid. We need a vacation." I said, "John, what we're doing is what a lot of people do for a vacation." He said, "Exactly. We need to do something different." And I said, "Okay, well, what do you got in mind?" He goes, "I'll tell you what I got in mind." He goes, "There's 8 beers left down in that creek right down there. Okay, I say we go down there, finish them this afternoon. That'll be a good start." I said, "Okay." He goes, "We can get our fishing poles out at the same time." And so we went down there, cracked open a beer, got our fishing poles, sat on the side of the creek, and that's when it happened. Our chance encounter. Sitting there with our poles in our hand, beers in our hand, all of a sudden we heard this little call. And we looked up, and about 30 yards from us, there were two immature goshawks in the tree right there. And one of them, you could see, had a little down on the top of their head. And the way they were flying, you could tell they were just fledged birds playing in the trees. And we watched them for all of about 10 seconds. And then they flew across the river, and we never saw them again. But that's all it took, was that chance encounter, because we were able to confirm that goshawks indeed nested in that area. And so when we wrote our report, we were careful to write that we saw these goshawks, but we also mentioned that more data was needed. and that we needed to continue the study, and that next year they should send us back up there at least two times to confirm where those nests are so that we can really get more data and nail this thing down. And the following year, PG&E said, yep, that's a good idea, and they sent us back again, and we got to do it again. Thank you.